Well, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Susmita Chatterjee, who's come from the University of Edinburgh, and she's going to speak to us today with an intriguing title, To Be or Not to Be, The Rise of Durga in Bengal. But perhaps you'd like to introduce yourself rather than me introducing you.
Okay.
So I'll hand it over to you.
Okay, I'm currently the Charles Wallace India Trust Fellow in the University of Edinburgh, particularly in the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities for 3 months. And I did my PhD in the Center for Historical Studies, Jawaharlal Nehru University, India. And I go back from here by the end of November, and I'll be joining Indian Institute of Advanced Studies, Shimla. So the paper that I'm going to present today is largely based on my PhD thesis. And as you can see, the title is To Be or Not to Be, The Rise of Durga in Bengal. And I can't see your face. Is that okay?
It's
like,
okay.
Squeeze in there.
So, I was in the British Library for the last few days, and there were posters all around about an exhibition on the evolution of English and how different words and phrases and terms have been borrowed into the English language. And do we need to switch on anything or do anything to it?
Oh, no, it's just doing
anything. It's all
automatic. Okay. So, and then it just so happens that when there is an interaction between different cultures and we see certain motifs, symbolisms, icons, whether that be in terms of language, body, places or spaces, then does it always remain what it was? And when we see it in different cultures, in different cultural appropriations, then what does it mean to be or not to be? As it has been long said, to be or not to be is the question. But in the next couple of minutes that I'm going to share with you, I'll be pondering on the question, what it means to be or not to be. And it will also be a reflection on how our choices or the choice between to be or not to be is determined by the relationship between being and time in crystallized moments, and also the relationship between becoming and the spatial spread of time per se. So, to get to the rise of Durga in Bengal, it's commonly said that Durga Puja, as we all know, is the greatest festival of the Bengalis, which is celebrated in autumn now. And Durga Puja is believed to have been popularized by 17th, 18th centuries as the public festival, which is now called to be Mahotsava. In the screen, you see that celebration of the great festival of the Devis in the month of Ashvina is a month in autumn, is being prescribed in one of the texts, which can be considered to be one of the earliest texts of the eastern region of the subcontinent, namely the Devi Purana. And it says that the Mahotsava of the Devis is to be celebrated with great pomp and splendor. There are, in fact, different prescriptions for the worship of different goddesses in autumn in the Upapuranas of the region, and the ritual prescriptions for worshipping different goddesses also vary. In the Devi Purana, the prescription of the worship of different goddesses in the month of Ashvina comes mainly as postscripts to the myths of the killing of Asuras, Ghora and Ruru by the goddesses, as well as also on other occasions. The Kalika Purana prescribes the worship of Durga, Bhadrakali and Ugrachanda, who are identified as one, namely as Durga, in autumn. The prescriptions that I have offered you so far does not give a singular prescription of the worship of Durga in Bengal during this period. Does that really mean that Durga Puja, as the Mahotsav of the Bengalis that we have today, is really a late medieval making? I would argue that the answer is no, because what we actually find from the Puranas is that there was the prevalence of the worship of goddesses, particularly warrior goddesses, which actually explains why the prescriptions for the worship of these goddesses comes as the postscript to the myths of the killing of different asuras. And the making of the great goddess, the making of Durga as the great goddess, comes up with a gradual process of the appropriation of the goddesses within Brahmanism in the initial years of its encounter. In that case, what does it mean to be or not to be for the rise of Durga in the Bengal context? Today, she is being worshipped usually in these forms. As you can see, the central figure is that of Durga. She's riding on a lion. She is killing Mahishasura. She is flanked by Lakshmi, Saraswati, Kartika and Ganesha. And Lakshmi, Saraswati, Kartika and Ganesha are said to be her four children. This particular structure, as you can see above, I choose this one because it gives her, if we can see the reflections beneath, no. Anyway, this particular structure where she is being installed is basically a temporary structure. It has the magnificence of the look of a temple, but these are all temporary pandals which are being constructed and being dismantled in after the period of 5 days during which Durga is being worshipped. This is the example of a Barwari Puja or public puja, and this is another goddess who is being worshipped in a family setup in the Durga Mandap, which is a permanent structure, but there are no Durga temples per se in Western Bengal, at least that I know of. Here, earlier I had shown you that she is flanked by Lakshmi and Saraswati, but here she is flanked by two goddesses. It doesn't move. They're similar to B. Lakshmi and Saraswati, except for their vahanas. They do not have any mount, and they're called Jaya and Vijaya. In popular perception now, Jaya and Vijaya are the sakhis or the friends of the goddess who come in. But this is how she looked like. It's really bad. Roughly in the 10th, 11th centuries. Here she is. It's very blurred, I'm really sorry, but it's clearer in my computer. Anyway, if I can just show a few things. She's not flanked by any other figures. The Mahisha is here, and she's riding on her mount lion, one step there, and she's killing the Mahisha with a trident. The interesting part of this picture, however, is this female figure who is being depicted as a warrior. And If I can just show some of you from here, as you can see, it's a female figure. It's clearly a female figure.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very rare sculpture where you actually see the female as a warrior, as it's evident to see. You can see the shield here. And when it's just not clear there, if you can have a look here. So she's the accompanying female figure here, right?
Yes.
With the shield.
Yes.
And this figure, you can also see, not only accompanying Mahishamardini figures, this is a Surya figure, and there are female warriors here. Clearly, if you can make out, right? So, in the process of the coming of Durga Puja as the central festival of the goddess in autumn for Bengalis and in the Bengal region, when we are looking at this period and when we are asking how Durga is becoming the great goddess, then there are a few associated questions. One, who makes her great and why? Two, what is at stake in the process of the construction of the Great One? And three, how do we account for the losses in the making of the Great? It may be well nigh asked that given the situation now where Durga Puja is being celebrated with so much of pomp and splendor, why am I talking about the losses? Why am I bringing in the question of who makes her great and how does it matter when she is so much a persistent presence in Bengali culture even today? Yet, the question is, and I get back to the starting point, what does it mean to be? Is it enough when we just see her in this form, when we just see the pomp and splendor and the ways in which she's worshipped, or are there other questions associated with it? The question is basically who she was, where she came from the goddess matrix or the goddess matrices, and who she is now. To be more appropriate, as it is not only about Durga, but about the huge goddess matrix that existed in Bengal, the question would be who they were and who she is. So to get back to my period and to give a brief overview, the encounter of the local cultures and Brahmanism in the historical context of Bengal starts roughly from 500-600 centuries CE. Before that, the eastern part of the subcontinent remained outside of the pale of the mainstream culture, which was coming down from the northwest towards the Gangetic Valley. And it was in this period that penetration of Brahmanism into the heartlands of the region is taking place. And this is the period when the composition of the local Puranas, which I'll deal with, takes place. And according to Kunal Chakravarti, the local Upapuranas were being composed by the Brahmin authors as the hegemonizing tool where they appropriated the myths of the local people, but continuously manipulated them, slowly altered them in order to hegemonize the local people and in order to make the normatives of Brahmanism more acceptable to the local people. I'll deal mainly with four Shakta Upapuranas of Bengal. They are the Devi Puran, dated 500 to 600 centuries CE, Devi Bhagwat Puran, 950 to 1200 centuries CE, Kalika Puran, 750 to 1100 centuries CE, Mahabhagwat Puran, 1000 to 1100 centuries CE. These are the dating of the texts by R.C. Hajra. As far as Devi Bhagwat Puran is concerned, other datings are being offered. I would argue that Kalika Puran is certain sections, I mean, Kalika Puran is composed partly later than the Devi Bhagavat Puran, and Mahabhagavat Puran is definitely later than the Kalika Puran, because there are certain chunks of verses which are clearly being taken from the Kalika Puran, but they're put in a very different context. It also comes out from the content of these four Puranas, and I'll give you a brief overview of the mythic content of the four Rupa Puranas. I have followed not the method of structural analysis of myths, which is actually common and widely prevalent for the study of Indian myths and mythology. Rather, I have looked into the changes in the surface level of the myths, the subtle myths, and see also how the core structures of the myths or the core myths have been gradually being replaced by other core myths. So in the Devi Puran, what abounds are the myths of warrior goddesses fighting in the battlefield. The goddesses are independent ones and they're not situated within the family. In the Devi Bhagavat Puran, the myths of the goddesses fighting in the battlefield are still to be found, but the woman or goddess as warrior is considered to be an exception. The question is being repeatedly raised as to how, being a female, the goddess can actually kill someone or be a warrior or be in the battlefield, and several other strategies are being applied to negate the warrior self and warriorhood of the goddesses. In this text, the great goddess is independent and autonomous, but her anshas or partial manifestations are depicted as wives of gods. In the Kalika Puran, the portrayal of the goddesses in the narrative and the prescriptive sections are quite contrary to each other. In the Kalika Puran, the first half is mainly about the myths, and in the later half, it deals with the ritual prescriptions for the worship of different goddesses. It talks about not only of Durga Puja, but also about specific rituals of associated with different other various goddesses. So in the narrative section, the goddess is the ultimate autonomous one in abstraction, but the embodied goddesses are spousified and subordinated to the husband lord, namely Shiva. In the prescriptive section, the goddesses are not related to gods and are either depicted to be killing asuras or standing on corpses. In the Kalika Purana, the myths of the goddesses fighting in the battlefield are almost nullified. They are narrated in a few verses and combined with the iconographic details of the goddesses, which stands in sharp contrast to the early two Puranas, which abounds in the myths of the warrior goddesses. In the Mahabhagavat Purana, the goddess is situated within the realm of the domestic as daughter, Kanya. The next term is really interesting. It's Kehini, the homemaker, and mother, Mata, and the autonomous space outside of the domestic is almost lost. The myths of the warrior goddesses is replaced by the myth of Rama killing Ravana. And if this be taken into consideration, it may be just pointed out briefly that now the idea popular in Bengal is that Rama introduced the worship of the goddess in autumn, because otherwise the prevalent practice was to worship the goddess in spring, and this is called Akala Bodhana. Akala means untimely. This, however, is not being borne out by the earlier references to the texts that I have cited. How the changes in the myths take place, and whether the changes in the surface level of the myths or the content of the myths actually mean something in terms of the identity of the goddesses and in terms of the goddess metrics, which is being now appropriated within the Brahminical literature and whom we now access through the lens of the Brahminical literature. The idea that crystallizes around the goddesses and the ideology through which the goddesses are being shaped are to be understood through certain strategies which actually negate or create new identities for the goddesses. Here I identify four strategies through which the construction of the great goddess Durga takes place at the cost of her old identity as the warrior goddess, and also at the cost of numerous other local goddesses who existed in the region, about whom now we no longer come to know about, or they are either obliterated or their meanings have been changed almost beyond recognition. I shall talk about 1. Identification. All the goddesses are one, it's a strategy which has been recognized, pointed out by scholars for quite a long time, that how in the Indian context different goddesses are being identified with each other. It's being done mainly in 3 ways. 1, there is an explicit claim that one or more goddesses are the anshas or partial manifestation of a particular goddess. So there is this one particular goddess who is assumed to be the great goddess, and then all other goddesses are said to have emanated from that particular goddess. 2, without the explicit claim, at times there is the use of free flow of names. So within a chapter or in 2 or 3 subsequent chapters, there can be the use of free flow of names, say, it's the reference to one particular character within the battlefield or within the domestic realm, and different names are being used in subsequent verses, which gives the idea that all these names are actually belonging to one particular goddess. 3, mythification of a goddess being born and reborn, and collation of the myths of rebirth in a uniform structure. One of the most popular examples that many of you will be familiar with is that of Sati. And after Sati's death, she is being born as Kali or Parvati. So there are different goddesses now who are being identified as one, who remain in different spatial orders, in different bodily figures, but are being collated into one single structure. The identification as a strategy of making great has been identified by very many scholars, while D.C. Sarkar working on the Pithas of the goddesses, or T.B. Coburn showing how the crystallization of the Devi Mahatmya takes place by taking in strands from the early Sanskritic literature, or in recent works by Tracy Pinchman. But what is not perhaps being emphasized or taken into consideration is that identification actually implies the loss of distinct identity of different goddesses. It actually obfuscates the goddess matrices, and it also constructs new identities of goddesses. What do I mean by the loss of distinct identity of different goddesses? Today, many of us would be familiar with the goddess Shiva, but Shiva is now more of an epithet, like auspiciousness of the kind. We do get not only the reference to Shiva as an independent goddess with definite traits and characteristics of her own, but she had a distinct iconographic form, and Devi Purana is more about the goddess Shiva. And with the process of identification, with the insertion of different names, at some point Shiva tends to be completely put to oblivion. Similarly, when, say, in the description of a battlefield, there are subsequent names of Chandi, Chandika, Ambika, and so on and so forth. If we have a look into the original structure, if we can try to look at it in that way, it may be that these were the different warrior goddesses, but now it all tends down to one figure, which then once again leads and helps to shape the identity of the goddess in a different way. Identification, most importantly, helps in the construction of new identities of the goddesses. In the goddess literature, one of the major gradients followed to identify goddesses are whether they're spousified or non-spousified goddesses, and it is taken to be both temporally and spatially static entities. Yet, For instance, in the case of Durga, till the end, Durga starts off as a warrior goddess, and even now, how the identity of Durga as the wife of Shiva is brought up is not so much by depicting Durga, even in the central mythic structure as the wife of Shiva, but by identifying her with Sati and with Kali Parvati. And then as it goes on, then it comes into the being that Durga is basically also the wife of the goddess, is also the wife of God Shiva, though the myths are all about the specified goddesses like Parvati or Kali. 2. Hyphenated disjuncture. Though there is identification in terms of names between different goddesses, there is a segregation in terms of textual positioning and or persona of the goddesses. For instance, in the Kalika Purana, as we have seen, we have two different characteristic portrayal of the goddesses in two different sections. Yet, in the Kalika Purana, Kali and Parvati would be the same figure, they're both dark, and they refer to the same persona. In the Mahabhagavat Puran, Kali is the dark goddess, nude, with disheveled hair. Parvati is of golden complexion from the very beginning. And Kali appears only in specific narrative junctures when either Sati or Parvati tends to break out or burst open the domestic narrative. So, as long as we follow the mythic narrative pattern, within the domestic, we can't continuously get the figure of Sati. And Kali comes in only when that normative structure is being disrupted. The classic model of splitting the goddess into the good and the bad, or the benevolent and the malevolent ones. Like the good goddess or the creative goddess is the one who gives birth, the one who is the creator, and the bad or the malevolent goddess is the one who is the destroyer, is not applicable in the Bengal context. The Bengal Upapuranas do not denounce the goddess as the bloodthirsty one. They're not being pushed to the realm of the polluted. Instead, they create new normatives of the feminine as the docile, tender, sexually appealing one, who are then gradually being brought within the realm of the domestic. And the texts throughout the end continue to hail the goddesses as the killer of the asuras. The goddess as the killer of Asura is thus not considered polluted, bad, or malevolent. Rather, she is eulogized as the bloodthirsty one. This term is important, perhaps, Asura Strik Priya. However, the goddess in her aggressive self, that is, in aggressive self, by aggressive self, I specifically mean that the goddess as the killer of the Asuras, or the goddess is appearing in the battlefield, appears only in specific junctures of a narrative, or in ritual prescriptions in the later Bengal Upapuranas. Hyphenated disjuncture, which is not merely the split of the goddess into two figures, where there is an identification and yet there is a segregation, is thus the loss of the goddess's language, though she is retained in her body and her voice can be heard. In order to explicate it, I'll give you the example of Kali. Today, Kali is known to be almost the singular goddess of her kind in the Bengal region, with this kind of an iconographic feature. In this period, we had numerous other goddesses who shared the iconographic features of Kali. And in earlier texts, Kali is not standing on Shiva, but on a corpse. The Mahabhagavat Puran eulogizes the form of Kali as the ultimate form of the goddess. Shiva himself first tries to dominate his wife as Sati. Sati breaks open that structure in the form of Kali. And then when she is reborn as Parvati, Shiva emphasizes and requests the goddess to show her ultimate form and the recognition that Kali is the form of the ultimate goddess comes from Shiva himself. Yet, while in the Sati episode, Kali can still be seen in a subjective self, later in the Kali Parvati episode, she just merely appears in front of Shiva. The acceptance is there. It's not pushing her to some other realm in that sense. She is being accepted within the mainstream narrative. But she just appears. She is not seen in the mythic structure elsewhere as the narrative follows. 3. Disembodiment. Disembodiment of the goddesses. The first instance, once again, this one that first comes to mind and many of you will be familiar with is the fragmentation of the body of the goddess as we see in the Sati myth. And like after the death of Sati, the body of Sati was being sliced to pieces and different body parts of Sati fall into different regions, and thereby and therefore these pitas came up. This sort of helps to integrate the different Shaktopitas, but it is important to remember that it is not about a particular female goddess, but about the fragmented body parts. 2. Appropriation of the autonomy of the person of goddess. Shiva Shakti, or the Shakti of Shiva, or the Shakti of different goddesses is a very familiar term, and in most parts of the subcontinent we do it, and it has been theologically and philosophically evolved in different ways. In the Devi Puran, I'm just giving one example for each of the points to elaborate. There are different, very many things can be brought out, but so it is Shakti who appears in person along with Shiva. The gods want to kill an asura. They know that it is Shakti who will be killing the asura, yet they go to Shiva in order to get the boon of killing the demon. When they approach Shiva, in the first place they see Shiva and Shakti sitting side by side. After a few verses, they see Shakti in the body of Shiva. And it is Shiva who grants them the boon. It is Shiva who grants them his Shakti. And now it becomes Shiva's Shakti, which is not in person, not the person of Shakti, but when he gives his Shakti, it becomes his Shakti, something of his form. And following him, there are other gods who bring out their own Shaktis or get themselves transformed into female forms, and that doesn't work. And finally, once again, Shaktis come out from the male bodies who are seen to be fighting in the battlefield. In the ultimate resort, it's the warrior Shaktis who reign the battlefield, but they come out through the mediation of the male bodies. And this mediation, only this part, through the appropriation of the autonomy of the person of the goddess, negates the kind of agency that the goddess would have in her embodied form. An alternative or an other kind of strategy is evident, where the existential autonomy of being of the goddess is being negated. Here, the goddess existed in person in the earlier myth that I narrated. This one, for instance, once again, a very popular one. The gods create the goddess out of their accumulated tejas or energy. They give her their weapons, and then the goddess goes to kill Mahishasura. It is so popular a myth that it rarely occurs to us that the goddess is being retained in her iconographic form, as we saw here, as the killer of the asura. But in popular memory, as well as in other texts, it comes to be so that she is not the warrior goddess in her own right, but she is able to kill the Asura because of the might, the combined might and energy of the gods, which in one sweep basically negates her warrior identity, though she is being retained in her iconographic form and the myths continue to be in a way what it was, apparently. So, this embodiment is the loss of the subjectivity of the goddess's female body, what it actually means. In the Kalika Puran, which upholds the worship of the yoni of the goddess, as Kamakhya is still believed to be the sacred site of the yoni of the goddess, birth from the yoni is denounced. Even goddess Kali is sent to perform penance, as she is born from the yoni of her mother. The female body which gives birth, the subjectivity of the birth-giving female body, is thus wiped off and negated. Two, as I explained, the strategy of disembodiment takes away the agency of the goddess as female, and particularly the identity of the goddess as female, who fights the unjust in her own right and with her own might and vigor. Finally, circumscription of the goddesses within family relationships. Initially, attempts were made to subordinate the goddess to a god, either Shiva or Vishnu. Gradually, she is being brought more within the domestic realm as the daughter, as the wife, as the mother. Parvati, the daughter of the mountains, Parvat Kanya is another term which is often being used in the earlier myths. But then a whole set of myths is being evolved where Parvati or Parvat Kanya is not merely the Kanya or the virgin who sports in the mountains, but who is the daughter of the father mountain or the father god in certain sense. And therefore it leads to the gradual changing not only in the meaning of the particular term, but in the whole set of circumstances and the locale within which the goddess is situated. Two, the goddess is mainly depicted as the wife, particularly of Shiva in our context, and in some cases also that of Vishnu or that of other gods. And she is a mother, though it is important to note that, like most of the Brahminical goddesses, the goddesses whom we find in our context do not give birth to a child. Neither Skanda or Kartikeya or Ganesha is being born out by the womb of the goddess. Rather, they are very conscious, deliberate attempts to prevent the goddess from giving birth to a child. She can only rear up the child after they're born, and she's seen only in that nurturing role. Circumscription of the goddesses within family relationships leads to the subordination of the goddesses to patriarchal norms of the family. The goddess herself becomes the role model for mortal women, and it operates vis-a-vis each other. And the loss of ethos which sustained the goddesses and the loss of ethos that the goddesses stood for is the ultimate victory of the Brahminical strategy of appropriation and making the goddess great. The contestation between the local cultures and the Brahminical culture keeps on going, because what we find in the Mahabhagavat Purana is not the watershed. The kind of things that Brahminism is trying to portray does not gain ground. We still have the figure of Mahishasura and the goddess being worshipped together. Yet the great goddess lives in the great tradition, being uprooted from the matrices, which is now lost. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chatterjee. That was a very interesting talk, I thought. We have 15 minutes or so for questions and responses. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You seem to have an axiomatic reputation of that idea that yes, Brahmanic has been Brahmanism has been has changed or transformed the earlier one. Can you give any proof for that? Because what is the proof for that earlier certain before Brahmanism supposed to Brahmanism came to Bengal, introduced to Bengal, there existed some certain god cults. Definitely there were goddess cults, not only in Bengal, throughout India, in the various regions. But how can you separate that this particular period, this was there? What is the literature in iconographical or liturgy evidence, or even folk literature? How can you establish that, prove that?
I give you the differences in the mythic structure which comes up between the 600 years, right? Now, in the Bengal situation, why it's... it is possible to kind of segregate things. It's largely because this area was remaining outside of the Pale. We do have definite evidence that this is the period, roughly from 5th, 6th century onwards, that Brahmanism is penetrating, and through like copper grants, it's going to the interior villages. We do have proof, archaeological, and particularly with the coming up of the Chandraketugar excavations, that people have been living here for centuries, and there were continuous kind of evolutions in different segments. In the Chandraketugar, which is excavations, we also have different female figures with elaborate headdresses with weapons, usually 5 to 10 or more or less. The texts that I was giving, I was describing here, they can be compared to be the earliest available texts of the period. We do have some other secular literature of the period, but which is coming up with the Palos and the Sainas and things like that. Now, one, this is the period throughout the subcontinent when the goddesses are coming up in full bloom in the Brahmanical literature. The goddesses are there in the Vedic literature, but they're not depicted as the ultimate one or in such figure elsewhere, right? So what is happening in this period that the Devi Mahatmya or the Chandi, which is being popularly called, which is part of the Markandeya Purana, is also considered to be roughly composed in this period, though according to some it's composed later. But if you also look at the South Indian situation, the Sthala Purana is being composed, there also the goddess is coming up with a great figure and prominence. So the question will remain that why the goddesses are coming up in full bloom in this period, and this perhaps we cannot understand otherwise except we take into consideration of the historical situation that was going on, right? Two is, you want to say something? Yeah.
Yes. There were existing goddess cults,
yeah,
throughout the area, many, many different parts. They were all popularized because in the same period you will have the Pallava, Mahishasura Mardini, the same, more or less same structure in the Pallava period, 6th century, 7th century. Then Nishumbha Sodhani in the 8th century, Chola, early Cholas. So the architectural form, iconography form, they were all becoming very popular. And they are all the plastic forms of the illustrations of the Devi Mahatmya legend, which is so popular. Which, so earlier goddesses cults appropriated, can it be viewed in different way, any other way than appropriation? Appropriation actually means, as you say, concluded, obliterated, obliteration of some earlier layer. So earlier layer, it is only a surmise, seems to be a surmise.
Yes, because we do not have any other access, because we do not have the...
Integrated into the Devi, in the Mahishamardhini cult, and popularized through the Devi Mahatmya and through the architectural iconography.
That's what I'm accepting, but in the process, what is happening? That is what I tried to show, that what was the identity of the goddess earlier and what is happening in the later period, say in the Bengal context. Today, or even for the period that I'm talking about, the sculptural evidences, the major section of the sculptural evidences are that of Vishnu, which is found throughout Eastern India. As you were mentioning about the Pallavas and the Cholas, you see, it's true that the goddesses are also coming into the fore. But all the major kingdoms that are coming up in this period are patronizing some male deity, which is happening all over the subcontinent. It's either being Vishnu or Shiva who is being patronized. And the major kingdoms do not have the patron deity as a goddess. It's only in the local peripheries, as we see in some parts of Orissa, where the local smaller kingdoms are taking up the goddesses, or it's happening also in smaller kingdoms outside of the main regions. And it's happening not only in the south, but it's also happening in Assam. It's happening in... They're all devotees, the kings are all devotees of Shiva or Vishnu. The question will be, like, when it comes, because Brahmanism had already, the Manu Sanghitas, or, you know, the other kind of normative literature had already taken shape prior to that, their coming to this region. So it had, it was already a patriarchal culture. Now, what is happening when these two cultures are coming into contact, and there is a kind of overlapping and things like that? The basic question that is why remains, though it's really difficult as to how we figure out what was there earlier. We can, at the moment, we can only do it through the architectural and sculptural remains, and also only through the texts that are available, given that these texts are in Sanskrit. In I really did not have the time to go into the detail of things, but what we really find, say, in the Devi Puran, there are innumerable depictions of goddesses, different goddesses, whose worship prescriptions, the ritual prescriptions throughout the year, at times spanning for, you know, 12 years or 60 years at a stretch, is being given. The detail of their iconographic features is being mentioned separately. And the myths, as I started off, it said, today we only know of Mahishasuramardini. Right, and any kind of goddess figure who's been depicted to kill someone, presumably an asura, is believed to be only Mahisha. But when we have so many myths of other goddesses, and they're not Durga, that is why I started off with that, it's not Durga, then it shows that it was popular in the culture where it comes from. Right?
For that, to know more about them, to know the difference of so many gods, it's better if tantras help you in that.
Right.
Because
in the,
tantra is fully, especially Bengal, Assam, that region is fully surcharged with tantras. So tantras have exerted greatest influence in the Upapuranas, which you have cited.
Yes,
so
but the
tantras
problem...
maintain the goddesses.
Yeah, but
not
the...
Only
no,
Shanta
the,
the
problem
tantra,
with the...
Vaishnava tantras also. Though they, the Vishnu or Shiva is the supreme god or god, there are so many different forms. Each one has its own dhyana, iconographical details, and worship also. The same also in Shaiva Agamas, Vaishnava Agamas also. But then they all claim that Shiva or Vishnu is the only deity. So different forms with their own visualizations, dhyana, etc. They are all maintained in the tantra. The being Purana, they amalgamate the text, they make them as giving a unified sort of picture. Whereas tantra maintain the individual variations of the same deity, different forms, different worship cults.
In the Bengal situation, it's different, because in Bengal, the Hindu tantras are coming into being in a much later period. So they're not earlier than 15th, 16th centuries. Okay. And in Bengal, Buddhism was also popular. So we have
Shaktism,
only the...
bifurcating as Hinduism and
whatever, like in
tantra.
No, but tantras were not
Buddhism
there.
And Hindu tradition. Because Buddhist Mahayana tradition also has so many Shakta deities, and there are so powerful mentioned.
Yeah, I mean,
so because dharma, worship of dharma, the mangala dharma, these are all common worship, which is tantra as a whole, which was practiced both by Buddhists and Hindus.
Yes, but Buddhist tantras, particularly basically in Bengal, since Buddhism came prior to the Brahminical cultures, as you were saying, exactly that's the point, because in since it's contemporary, we have greater access to make comparison between Buddhist tantras and the Upapuranas, because these are the contemporary literature. And it's very true that we have greater access to the understanding of what it was, in terms of exegesis, ritual practice and praxis, through the Buddhist tantras. In this case, it's Buddhist tantras. I'm saying Buddhist tantras because all these texts, they are engaging with Mahayana philosophy largely, and then also making differences, you know. So one of the major arguments that I have really is that there is no point in saying that who borrowed from whom, like whether it's Hinduism borrowed from Buddhism or Buddhism borrowed from Hinduism. It's rather to be looked through the local cultural matrix. But the only problem in this case is particularly for the Bengal situation is like something that we have for the Kashmir situation or for the South Indian situation we don't have is because the tantras are much later compilations, so even there, like, you know, you don't get, we get the references to different goddesses, but what the practices were, it's very difficult to understand because it's now being so very sieved and just the ritual sections are being put. So what the meanings were, what they implied, it's very difficult to find out.
Yes, but maybe many tantras may be later, as you say, 13th, 14th century, but there are still earlier Shakta tantras, like Kolarnava.
They Kula are Lama not
tantra, Kalika tantra.
They are not so late. There are references to like Kalika tantra, Garuda tantra, Durga tantra. They're all referred to. Okay, like we find the references in the Upapuranas, but they are not found anymore. So that's the problem. I mean, if we could find them, then it would have actually altered our understanding to a great degree. But most of the texts are, and they said now, like, there's a debate, so like whether it all existed or not, maybe tantra had a different meaning, so that creates the problem in this situation.
In that way, like, just as to state the Shaiva Agamas, they are still preserved especially in the Tamil. So we can see the very earlier structure, though there are literal ritual padhatis.
That's an advantage with that region, basically.
Yes, they systematized, taking matter from various agamas, even a unified one. But still the earlier different agamas are still preserved. So we can trace.
Yeah, that's the advantage here. Yes. We do not have that. That's the problem, basically. Yeah, that is why, since these are available texts, so like we have to try to get on with that. In fact, my next project will be on Buddhist tantras. That is why I chose the Buddhist tantras, to see, you know, how if we can make a comparison and then get a broader out view and also try to figure out the world view as to what existed.
From what you've been saying and about the appropriation of the goddess by the Brahmanical tradition and her representation, I thought it was very thought-provoking, but can you make inferences then, would you want to make inferences about social conditions? I suppose you would. What's the relationship between ideology, if you like, and the social structure, as it were? Can we, because we know so little about that, but we have to make inferences about it, presumably. So would part of your claim also be, therefore, that these societies move from a less patriarchal society, if you like, to a more patriarchal society?
Yeah. Basically, I do not know whether it was matriarchy or what existed, you know, that I really don't know. But what I can do find out is that the normatives were really different, because one instance can be, say, even today, very many women, or it has been a part of tradition that one wants Shiva as the husband, though, like, he does not fit into the category of wanted husband, right? It's somewhere the love component played, and he cared for his wife and whatever. In the Kalika Purana comes in, it's more about, it depicts the sexual amour between Shiva and the goddess. It's not merely the sexual amour part, it's more about the love, the passion, the urge to unite, and it goes beyond, which is being gradually culled or within that particular Purana, and more so in the later Puranas. And that is how she is also to be shown as, you know, the domesticated, and where he becomes the lord, because if there is an equal partnership, if it operates in that way, then the husband as the authority of the family, to whom the wife has to bow down, and the husband becomes the Ishta Devata, kind of, who is to be worshipped like the Lord, really doesn't occur. So at least we have different kinds of traces of these sorts through which we can figure out what it was or from which certain practices did evolve. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely like what's more prominent is how these, because if it's a different kind of a society altogether, then how do you implement certain normatives? It cannot happen and grow within one day. And that's one of the basic questions for how patriarchy works, because for so many centuries across the globe, a half of the chunk of the population have been made to behave in certain ways. How could that happen? How did that happen? So it gives us an inkling of the processes as to how that was happening. Another example will be, as I was saying, that it's all about the warrior goddesses. So she is being retained in the battlefield, but elaborate dialogues are being introduced where the Asura envoy constantly says, but you know, you are a woman, how can you fight? Oh no, you see, your glances are the arrows and your eyebrows are your bows, and you are kidding, come on, you can't fight. So finally at that point she does not give in to it, but it helps to bring up the normative of the sexual feminine and how a female is to be visualized. So that gradually shows that how these normatives were being built up, and there are breaking up of the structure as well, which actually is perhaps the greatest proof of the pressure from below, because there are these fissures within the myth, it gets disrupted. Again, there are attempts, and there are superficial attempts of cementing layers. So it's true that I'll definitely say that is how the patriarchal structure with the normatives that Brahminism have is coming up.
This is a very quick question. In your slides, you mentioned the Mahabhagavata. Is this the same as the Bhagavad Purana?
No, Mahabhagavata is a Shakta text.
Because I've come across Devi Bhagavat and Kalika.
Yeah, Mahabhagavata is not so well known.
It's
right?
Not so well known.
Yeah.
Well, we have to move on. Thank you. Oh, go on then.
Thank you.
Just a little last question. When we talk about domestication of the female in the Puranas and everything, I'm thinking, and the fact of this kind of process of integration between the patriarchal Brahminical society and a more female-oriented village environment, then I'm thinking of the example of the Vaishnava, or the worship of Radha, for example. There it seems like all these strategies of domestication gets a little bit corrupted, it seems like, because...
Can you just put that part again? I don't
I think about Radha and Krishna,
mm-hmm.
and how Radha, at least in the Vaishnava literature,
mm-hmm.
I mean, she lives in a family environment,
mm-hmm.
she's domesticated, but then, in the night she goes off to the forest,
mm-hmm.
and meet Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and also she's is described in the Vaishnava literature, like the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there is the statement that she is even more powerful than Krishna because she can attract
mm-hmm.
Krishna's
mm-hmm.
love. And through that, she can control Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So there it seems like there is a kind of breach.
Mm-hmm.
She's a little bit out of the classical Brahminical mm-hmm. stereotype of the
mm-hmm.
female, really.
Mm-hmm.
How would you, within the frame of the theory of
mm.
the domestication of the female,
mm.
that seems to be an exception, or how...
No, I'll not actually say that it's an exception, and that therein, once again, you know, the historical continuity thing will perhaps go on.
Yeah.
As I was telling you earlier, that we always say Vaishnavism, and it's Vishnu, but it's
yeah.
all about Radha
yeah.
and Krishna.
Yes.
So one of the major shifts that happens in this period is perhaps the coming up of the Radha and Krishna figure, which somehow sustains the basic ideas that were already existing, because the kind of the idea of love to the divinity, for the divinity,
uh-huh.
where is a kind of a replacement of the love between two individuals. So that's more, and as you can see even in the Radha Krishna literature, it's more about, it's divinized also, the love is divinized now,
mm-hmm.
the mainstream, but it's more about the divine love, and
yes.
and then the rest of the things follow.
Yes.
But so one way, it's a kind of like while those figures could not sustain themselves, and we actually have references where it is being said that now Kali comes up in the guise of Krishna, because this is a time where she has to be underground.
Right.
And we also have references like in our family temple, Shamsundar is being decked up as Kali, which should not happen,
mm.
being it popular Vaishnava center for so many centuries. So that will perhaps be like, that is how the local cultures continued to shape and shape the dominant things. And that is why I said that it continued. I mean, the contestation continued. It could not be wiped off at one go. But Radha did not, I mean, Radha, the stereotype of Radha or the female bhakti, that remained as one of the strands, but that was not the only strand, and then the rest of the things also came up, though the female as the ultimate source is remained, I mean, has remained, and it has remained even today. And that is why Indian cultural tradition has been shaped in so very different ways from say the Western culture, because it was never wiped off at one go. The persistent presence remained. It has to be. It had to be negotiated times and again. Yeah. And so it was constantly shaping the philosophy and the theology of its times, times and again, times and again, times and again, and it continued. So that made a lot of difference, basically.
Thank you very much. Well, on that note, we should move on. Thank you so much, Dr. Chatterjee. Very
thanks
interesting
a lot.
And stimulating.